Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm feeling good.
Thank you for picking me up and driving me to work today.
I'm the greatest.
Car still in the shop. Thank you very much. I was reading about some classes that are being offered, and I thought it was very interesting. We've been doing a bunch of consulting recently. Sadly, it's a lot of the first-time consulting where they pay the retainer and use it up to... we're not ready to do this yet.
Most of the consulting we do, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but most of the consulting we do is the 1 or 2 hour... I'm sorry, this is a really bad idea.
Many of the jobs we do are people...
More than half, we say, you should rethink your approach and get some appropriate training.
But the consulting jobs where they hire us, we work for many, many hours.
Of course.
I think that if you're looking to get into the business, there's a lot to be read out there. There's a lot to say for working in the business. And even folks who work in one aspect of the business, if you're front of house, if you're a chef, and usually the guys who front of house and chef, unless you've worked very closely with the bookkeeper, and even if you know the operations of a restaurant.
One of the first things I did when we were getting ready to open a restaurant is I took two classes at Rutgers, which I had graduated from already. I took two classes. I took a business law class, and three classes, actually. I took a business law class, I took accounting one, and then I took accounting two. Just because I wanted to be familiar with the things that my business was going to need.
Well, and where a lot of folks don't have the complete picture is you'll have somebody who has operations of the restaurant down completely, front of house, back of house, and the day-to-day finances of an up. But, you know, you got to know what the real estate implications are. You got to know what laws not to break, what tax forms to file.
What questions you can ask in an interview.
Yeah.
Like not being able to ask somebody if they have a ride to work or not.
No, right. You can't ask them if they have a car. Mm-hmm. You can ask them if they can get to work every day, but you can't ask them how.
Right.
You know, and you wind up asking that question, and you've broken the law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyway. So I thought what was really great is there's a series of lectures by culinary entrepreneurs, including Danny Meyer and Amy Sherber, and they've been scheduled through December at the Institute of Culinary Education at 50 West 23rd Street in New York, if you're around the New York area. Lectures by Michael Guinor of Hudson Valley Foie Gras, Rob Kofelt of Mary's Cheese. The lecture series is from 6 to 8 p.m. in the evenings usually, and they're about $175 for the series. Going to a class like this is, I think, invaluable to hear other people's perspectives. Now, remember, when you hear someone give an hour lecture on how they started their business, they really don't have time to tell you very much, but you know, it's a good way to get many different insights.
And you're going to get different perspectives. You're going to get 6 or 7 different perspectives from very different types of ownership. And for me, and I'll give you just a 1 minute version of my perspective on this, and if you listen to the show, you've gotten a lot of my perspective on this. It's very, very difficult, but the hardest part of this, even beyond sourcing great food and making sure that we serve great food every day and service and all that other stuff, the hardest part of opening the business and starting the business was getting around the legalities of this. And I don't mean getting around it, but actually navigating it, navigating the legality, paying the life hazard tax that I didn't even know I had to pay. I still don't know what a life hazard tax is, but I do know that I write a check out for $475 every year.
And, you know, the other thing that a lot of restaurateurs who don't know the business side of it, and there are a lot of guys who come and they know the business side of it, but they don't know the rough and tumble of the kitchen, you know. And there are a lot of guys who know the rough and tumble of the whole operation, but they don't know the business of it. And these are some lessons that Mark's dad's in business, Mark's brother's in business. They help teach us a lot. Mark knows a lot about business from school. And we've learned a lot over the years that just you can't afford to mess up. We talk to a lot of people who bring us in for consulting jobs, and I'm amazed at how many people don't know whether or not they're making money until the end of the year. Because how much money you have in the bank does not mean
it's not necessarily reflective of your
business
making
money. You made or lost
money.
Because in certain months your cash flow will go up, but your debts will go up. And then the next month, the people look at the, and they're like, oh, well, there's this much in the bank account this month. And we look at the records and we say, yeah, but in 45 days, you're debt.
Right, you're going down.
You're going down.
You have to pay all the bills from when being busy now and during a slow period.
And so that gives you 45 days to figure out a plan. Whereas many restaurateurs, they look at the money in the bank every day, like, I guess we're okay. Oh, no, we're out of money. What are we going to do? You know, and that stuff is really boring. It's a part of our jobs that we don't really love that much, but we've got to do. Anyway, if you want to sign up and find out a lot more about the business of the restaurant business, and it's interesting even if you're just a spectator to see how it works, they have great speakers. The Institute for Culinary Education, their number is 212-847-0770. We'll put that up on our website as well, the Institute for Culinary Education. It's good to hear as many people speak as you can go hear speak before you get your butt into this thing.
And again, you could know everything there is to know about how to produce great food and how to produce great service, but if you don't know the payroll laws, you're screwed. If you don't know how to collect... not income tax. If you don't know how to collect sales tax, you're going to be in trouble. And if you don't know when the due dates of those things are and how they get paid and how they get electronically filed, there's so much minutia. And I'm sure I'm boring you with some of the. I know I'm boring Francis.
I can see
the look on his face.
I'm sorry.
But there's so much minutia that goes with. And this is, frankly, owning pretty much any kind of business. There's so much minutia that goes with it that you must acquaint yourself with those things before you can start your own restaurant.
So you know what the other thing that's really funny is something that we've acquired? And I'm glad we started with a small restaurant, and we now have two rather large restaurants. And what we never do in the consulting side of things, but what many great restaurateurs do, almost all great restaurateurs do, restaurateurs, operations restaurateurs, you're a handyman. You're a Mr. Fix-It, and as clumsy as you are, Mark, in the beginning, you're not really clumsy, but in the beginning, you weren't allowed to touch the power tools. I don't know if you recall.
Yes.
It's amazing how much stuff you learn to fix equipment as you go. Because
and even when you're not fixing it, it's a troubleshooting.
Right, you can analyze it.
You say, oh, the air conditioner's not working in the back room. Well, my guess is the dishwasher who used to change the filters doesn't work here anymore, so go and check the air filter. You probably don't have enough airflow going through the air conditioning system.
Right.
And... oh, my goodness, that was what it was.
It's funny because our staff, they'll call me on the phone. Rarely. I mean, we have a great staff, and we have levels of maitre d's and assistant maitre d's and an office manager. But sometimes people call me at home, and they'll identify a certain problem. Mm-hmm. I'll say, oh, look, it's circuit breaker 19 in the back, and check that, and then just flip it on and off 2 times, it'll work. And they'll look at me like I'm a warlock.
Right.
You know?
Like you're supposed to bang the side of the machine 6 times and see what happens.
A little Fonzie factor going on there. But, you know, it's important, and that's sort of there's a certain amount of scrappiness that I think that unless you're in a
especially, large... That's what I was just about to say, especially when you're operating a small business, and a lot of this came from when Francis and I were operating a single unit,
right.
48 seats,
you don't have
a little bar.
Department.
There's no such thing as a maintenance guy. Your air conditioning department.
Sure. So if you call the air conditioning guy to come in who charges $115 to show up and, you know, $75 an hour to be there, and he walks in and says, oh, it's this loose wire, see?
You didn't plug this in.
You know. And we had a little bit of that in the early days.
Of course.
But we don't anymore. And you know, I think that's one of the things that it's part of the adrenaline rush of having a small place and one of the things you like about it. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Mary Ewing Mulligan is a master of wine, president of the International Wine Center in New York City, and executive director of the United States Programs for London's respected Wine and Spirits Education Trust. Among several books that bear her name is the best-selling Wine for Dummies and her most recent book, Wine Style, which you should definitely pick up. We'll be talking about at the end of the show. You can read her column for the New York Daily News, and you'll occasionally run into her writing in publications like Food and Wine Magazine, The New York Times, The Wine Spectator, Newsday, and Gourmet.
Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Francis. It's great to be with you.
Likewise. Now, we've known each other for a number of years now.
Don't say how many.
Just a short time ago, I was teaching my first wine class, and the New York Times was gracious enough to write an article on it, which I really loved, and they called you to sort of run the wines that I had selected by a couple of people. I think they called you and Kevin Zarelli, and you commented that it looked like a great class, and your only criticism was that I was pouring too many wines per class. Let me tell you something. That was the best criticism anyone ever made for a guy in New Jersey. It's like saying you had too much food. I was packed. So thank you.
And Mary, you'll be happy to know we had that framed, and your name has been up on the wall of our restaurant.
So in other words, everyone came because they knew they were going to be getting too many wines?
Well, exactly.
Welcome to New Jersey. So Mary, you have the Master of Wine degree. In fact, you were the first, I know you know this, but our listening audience might not, you're the first female MW in the country.
Uh-huh.
And the two degrees that we've had on a number of MWs and a number of MSs, but the two degrees that really matter as far as our end of the wine business are the Master of Wine and the Master Sommelier degree. What's the difference between the two? What's a Master of Wine do?
That's the million-dollar question.
That's my job. I'm the radio guy.
Masters of wine really are in all sorts of aspects of the wine business. I mean, I'm an educator and a writer. There's a master of wine who's president of Robert Mondavi Winery. There's a master of wine who who's the wine buyer for Sam's Clubs. All sorts of things. There are some consultants. The major distinction between Master of Wine and Master Sommelier is that Master Sommelier concerns itself with wine service issues, and Master of Wine does not. Now, you know, we're always being asked this. All of us MWs are always being asked the difference between MW and MS, and all of the MSs, I'm sure, are being asked the difference all the time between MS and MW, and there are precisely four people in the world who are qualified to answer that, and I'm not one of them, but those are the four people who hold both titles. And what I understand from talking with them is that that's the main difference because, you know, I've obviously never gone through the MS program myself. But it's not, MW is a written exam. It's not an oral answer exam. It doesn't concern itself with how you perform on your feet the way that a wine service exam such as MS would. It does require lots of trade experience. The exam has lots of coverage of issues that are significant to the trade, whether it's quality control or wine marketing issues, things like that.
Well, you know, you said something very interesting, and I want to clarify for people. You said, you know, all of the MWs, how many MWs are there?
There are 250 in the world, and there are 22 in North America.
Yeah, 22 in North America. This isn't your average MBA degree.
No.
I want to ask you a question that I know you get asked a lot, but I want to ask it to you because you did break down some barriers here. You were the first female MW in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find extra challenges because you were female going through the MW program?
You know, I'd love to say yes. I think more telling than my having been the first female is that it was 10 years before another female came along.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that happened to be one of my students, which makes me very proud. I think that, so that implies a challenge for women. I think the challenge for women is that we lead such busy lives that it's hard to pursue MW also, in addition to doing whatever else we do. I was very lucky to have a really supportive husband who himself is a writer and is involved in wine and a wine collector. And his support was just invaluable to me in passing. If someone doesn't have that kind of support and maybe has a couple of kids to boot, then I just don't know how any woman finds the time to devote to it. But in terms of my having been the first, the fact is that it was not open to Americans until 1988. And I sat the exam for the first time in 1989 and passed half of it in 1990. So the challenge for all of us, male and female, who were sitting those exams as the first Americans sitting, was simply that we didn't know what to expect. We didn't have the structured educational background that the British had. Those courses were not available in this country. And as a result, we just sort of went in on the strength of our years in the business. And
just experience.
Yeah, really, and, you know, cramming some books and crossing our fingers.
I want to ask, because we only have a few seconds left in this segment, I want to come back and talk more about how this education is available a little bit more in the United States today, but how did you acquire your knowledge to be able to, the year after it becomes available, with no benefit of the coursework that's now available, how were you able to pass half the exam in a year? That's pretty monumental.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, I guess I was really lucky because I was working at a wine school already. International Wine Center already existed, and I was working there, and we had, among other things, a program of visiting winemakers, a wine club where visiting winemakers came every week, and I had the enormous advantage of being able to ask an expert once a week, face-to-face, anything.
Wow. Hey, that's incredible. Listen, our guest is Mary Ewing Mulligan. We'll be talking more with her. She is a master of wine, one of the 22 masters of wine in North America. And we'll be talking more with her about wine in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Mary Ewing Mulligan. She is a master of wine, and we're here talking about the subject in which she has expertise held and a degree held by only 21 other folks in all of North America. When we were talking earlier about when you were one of the first Americans to sit the year after it became open to Americans for this very prestigious degree, you did it without benefit of structured coursework that was available to Europeans.
Right.
You spent a lot of your time working to make sure that structured coursework is now available
exactly,
to Americans.
Exactly, creating the structured coursework.
What's available to Americans out there now?
Well, what had not been available now is basically the WSET program, and that's the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. It is the collection of courses that the British MWs always took. They took them before they were MWs, and in fact, in the UK, it's still a requirement that you must hold the highest WSET level, which is called diploma. You must hold that before you can present yourself as a candidate, as an MW student, as an applicant for the MW programs. And these are, I was amazed. I mean, I knew I wanted to get these courses into this country. I didn't know what I was asking for. I remember the first day that I got a shipment of course materials in, and I opened up the box and I looked at them, and I called, well, I sent a fax in those days over to the UK, and I said, I want you to know how proud I am to be offering these programs, because the materials were so thorough, so good, so well thought out. And they've been doing education, wine education for the trade in the UK for 35 years. So, you know, they figured it all out.
Would you put an MW, and it's hard to compare apples and oranges, but would you say it's on the level of, say, a PhD?
We do find ourselves using that comparison a lot. And in fact, now, this wasn't true when I passed, but now you have to write a dissertation in order to pass, which brings it closer to a PhD. Right. It's definitely postgraduate level work. I mean, that's for sure.
Well, I think that having just knowing you and a couple of the masters that I know and seeing the work that you do, I think it's really incredible. We have to take a short break for the news, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Mary Ewing Mulligan about the wine world in America and what it's like to have a wine career, a very specific trajectory, and what's going on with young people today, because I think that's very, very exciting. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Mary Ewing Mulligan is a master of wine. She's president of the International Wine Center in New York City, and she's executive director of United States programs for London's respected Wine and Spirits Education Trust, which helps prepare people to get the Master of Wine degree. The Master of Wine degree is held by 22 people in all of North America, and we're very pleased to have her join us on the show. Mary, I think I'm 40, and I've been doing this for about 20 years. And I have seen, in a way, I'm sort of jealous, because when I started, this thing had just started to pick up steam. And in New York City, there were a number of eager young sommeliers and people who work in wine shops. But
yeah, there weren't a lot of places to learn.
Not too many. And then outside New York City, most people didn't know anything. You know, or outside the major cities, most people didn't know anything. Now I see lots of young people who view the restaurant business and the wine trade as viable career options and respectable career options. And I see a lot of really eager young people who, even if they're not, you know, pursuing that level of excellence, who know the wines in their cellar or on their store shelf, and who are reading books and learning about wine for real. Do you see the same sea change I do among young wine professionals?
Absolutely. There is the wine business today is nothing like it was 20 years ago. Partly this is a generational thing, as you say. I think that we also would have loved to take advantage of those opportunities if they'd been available to us at the time, but they weren't. But now it's by necessity, because there are so many different wines in the world. Wine has become such a different business than it was 20 years ago.
Well, when you got your Master of Wine degree, was it important that you knew a lot about the wines of Chile and Argentina and those places that have really become important since?
It was, and in some cases I was at a little handicap because, for example, I had to go to London to take the exams the first two times, and I had, from reading some British publications, I had heard that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc was really hot. This was in 1990. And I had never tasted a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Right.
And so one of the things that I did when I got over to London is I hightailed it to a wine shop and I bought a bottle of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and tasted it. And wouldn't you know, the next day, there it was on an exam.
Wow. Prescient. Prescient. Well, you know, but the other thing that I think is interesting is, I mean, for me, there's a great advantage of being close enough to New York to really be influenced by it, but far enough away to sort of, you know, I live in Jersey City, which is right across the river, and that's really dominated by the New York cultural scene. I don't see a lot of, I'm going to get some hate mail from this, but I don't see a lot of really prominent and important restaurants that are destination restaurants in Jersey City. But out where we are in New Brunswick, and when you get about 40 minutes out, you're far enough out to be a destination to some people and not totally overshadowed by New York. I think, you know,
right,
when you get to within a mile of the Holland Tunnel,
you are literally in the shadow,
right,
of the
right. But what I see out here, you know, I knew a little bit. You know, I took Kevin Zarelli's consumer class, was the first thing that I did, and I got to taste a lot of stuff because I happened to work in a place where everybody wanted to be, and then I'm a reader. And I knew, I mean, what I now look back as, I knew less than my assistant sommeliers know now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a wonder kind, you know, and I think that the competition among young people that work for me and that work in other restaurants, very, very different. It's valued now among that line level employee.
But it's not. But I don't think it's just competition. And I think Mary hit on this earlier in the conversation. There's so much more available now. I see wines in the marketplace that I never would have seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Significant wines from Sicily, for instance, were wines that you didn't see. Real Marsala, for instance, which you didn't see. The only Marsala we saw back in the late 80s, early 90s was the salted stuff that was on the supermarket shelf.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Baron.
You know, I think what's happening is that, it's all about passion, and there's more today to feed the passion, and
mm-hmm.
when you feed the passion, there's more in terms of different types of wine, there's more information about wine, there are newsletters, there's the internet, you can't discount how much that has done in order to keep people in tune with what's going on in the wine world, wine classes, books, etc. And when you feed the passion, when someone has the passion and then turns to these resources to satisfy their passion, it just ends up feeding the passion all the more. And I don't think it's competitive. I agree. I don't think it's competitive that one young person in a restaurant is competing with somebody else. They're just each personally feeding their own passion for wine.
Well, let's talk for a minute. You spend a lot of your – you're an author, and you spend a lot of your time in educating, and I had the great good fortune to sit in someone who's a candidate for the MW, sit on a tasting panel where you participated, mm-hmm. and it was a wonderful insight for me to be able to do that. So you spend a lot of your time helping people at the very high end of the knowledge chain, of the food chain, really go for the gold, for the highest level of degree. But you've also co-authored with your husband, Ed McCarthy, Wine for Dummies.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that you spend time both at the super high level and introducing novices to wine. First of all, how do you approach those people differently, and do you like one more than the other?
You know, I enjoy both, and I think that the secret to being able to talk to people at a very basic level is having enough knowledge that you can get beyond the knowledge, that you can get beyond the information. I think where a lot of people get stuck is in an intermediate level where they've acquired some information and they love the information they've acquired, and they can't see the forest for the trees, so they end up, you know, just talking the information all the time, and it becomes too much for a casual wine drinker.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you can finally get beyond all that information, stand back, see the really big picture, then you can actually say to someone, you know what, it's okay if you like White Zinfandel, enjoy it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And not feel that you must convert that person into another kind of wine, because White Zinfandel isn't good enough for people to drink.
Well, I think it's also really hard, and it's hard in a radio show. It's hard when you're writing a book to talk about wine and capture what we talk about when we're talking about wine or experiencing wine, because wine, like food, is very experiential. So it's different. It's a difficult translation through pages or like I said, through a radio show to completely communicate that.
But I also think that, Mary, what you just said was very interesting about how I'll take that as a jumping off point to say that I think that some people like to talk about wine. And I don't like this, but some people like to talk about wine to sort of set themselves apart and show you how much they know. Whereas
yeah.
I think the best wine use to which wine can be put is to bring people together, you know, to share some wines. But very often with the young people that we train, we get to the what we call the little knowledge is dangerous thing stage, and you know, you pull somebody aside sometimes, table side, because we're more concerned with the sommelier side of things. We actually sell wine and train wine staffs for being sommeliers, and we say, you know, you're boring the tar out of the customer. You know, I mean, look at his eyes. Because some people want to talk with you about the subsoils and the phenolic compounds.
Right, but that man's all glazed over, and he'd really like,
you know,
a glass of Burgundy now.
What it really is, and this was something that came to me when I was writing Wine for Dummies, and I've just come back to this constantly as my touchstone in wine. The only thing that makes sense is really that wine is two separate products. And one product is a beverage, and that's you know, the yellow tails and all the animal labels and the $5.99 Merlots and all of that. It's just a beverage, and some people just want a beverage, and they don't want a lot of baloney with it. They don't even necessarily want a wine glass that has a stem on it,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want a cork necessarily. And then wine is art and fine wine. And that's a whole other thing. And I think that an awareness that wine is these two products and understanding where a particular person is coming from, whether it's someone who's a diner at a table, or whether it's a listener, or whether it's as a listener, you've got both kinds of listeners, so you guys have a tough challenge, or whether it's a reader, you know, at least a book you can target to a particular reader. And understanding where that person's coming from and being able to address that level of wine.
Well, and the thing is, very often you take people who like to drink wine, the beverage, you know, the two-buck
uh-huh.
chuck,
uh-huh.
and they'll eventually sort of get interested themselves and go over and say, hey, you know what, maybe there's something more here. Same as guy who reads a dime novel, at least he's
sure.
reading, maybe he'll go to more. But you can't push somebody, you know?
Right,
and
right.
that's, I think, where people get into a little bit of trouble. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Mary Ewing Mulligan, Master of Wine, talking about the state of wine in America today. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's an approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest is Mary Ewing Mulligan. She is a master of wine, one of the preeminent authorities on wine in the country. And I wanted to ask you, Mary, it's almost hackneyed, the raging debate now about where the scoring of wine fits into how people select wine. And, you know, is a 97-point Robert Parker wine necessarily better than an 89-point Robert Parker wine?
Right. Well, you know, I that's one of the things that drives me crazy about wine. And I have to say also that I, when I write about wine in certain venues, I score the wines.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's what's expected now in our marketplace, so we can't be criticized for doing it. But in an ideal world, I wish that the scores didn't exist, because I believe that it leads wine drinkers down the path of quality above all. And this is really a mistake, because what does quality taste like? Okay, someone comes in and is ordering a leg of lamb in your restaurant, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what are you going to give them? You're going to give them 93 points or 88 points?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Okay, what if the 93 points is white,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not going to go with the leg of lamb?
Right.
But the 85 points is a lovely little modest Merlot that's going to go beautifully with the leg of lamb. It's the same thing for individuals who are choosing wines for themselves in a wine shop, in a restaurant. You have to give priority to what you like and what is your taste. And then, within that style of wine that you like, you can look for the best example. You can say to a retailer, I really like this wine. Do you have another wine of this style that's a particularly fine example? And you can climb the quality ladder that way within the context of a style. But quality, for its own sake, forget about it.
You know what, Mary? I like what you've done there, though. Let's stop naming wines, and we'll just call them points. I'm my new wine, 93 points is spectacular.
You know, but you know what's funny? The other thing is, you know, there are quantitative quality judgments to wine, but so much of it is subjective. And I pointed out, I taught a. I usually charge a decent amount of money to do wine lectures, but last night my father's social club, the Friendly Sons of the Shillelagh, needed a little benefit. So in the church basement arena of wine tastings, I did for $15 a wine tasting that I should have charged like $5,000 for. But one of the things that I stressed with them was I picked, and you know the wines, Mark, I didn't tell you what I did, I picked... There was a California Syrah that was done with when we went out and visited this guy Thomas Coyne. He had half of it in American oak barrels, half of it in Hungarian oak barrels,
mm-hmm.
and he was intending to blend it. So Mark and I bought a barrel of each separately because we liked them,
mm-hmm.
and a barrel of the blended wine,
mm-hmm.
and they're all $45 retail. Mm-hmm. And we talked. People wanted to go back to. Well, I like this one better. Mm-hmm. I like that one better. This one's the best. That one's the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, when you read books, do you rate them? Do you say, you know, this is the best book, and this is the second best book, and this is the 89-point book, and this is the 78-point book?
Right.
You're not. It's not a constant search for the best book. That's not why you read books.
Yeah.
And
I'm just gonna to take the other side of this, just for the sake of discussion. You know, sometimes you only have a certain amount of time to read a book,
mm-hmm.
and you want to buy the best book.
Yeah.
I think that scoring wines is a wonderful thing to do individually. I'm so glad that this system exists. And, of course, you know, the 20-point system existed before the 100 did, so something did exist. Because it's my shorthand of remembering which one I thought was a better wine than the other one. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to what you're going to drink, that's secondary. First thing is, what does it taste like?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And the other thing about the 100-point scale is, I think that the 100-point scale from Robert Parker and the Wine Spectator was instrumental in making wine seem accessible to a number of people who started drinking wine as a result of it. And I think that's really, that's another fabulous aspect of it.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, whatever brings people in and enables them to discover this wonderful beverage that we all love so much, that's a great thing.
But it's funny, last time I was in Spain with a friend of mine, and he knows I'm in the wine business, and he's not, but he was busting my chops. We were walking around the Prado Museum, and he would say, "See that Degas? I give it an 89. The Velasquez, 94. You can rate your whole life that way, you know? Well, Mary, and the International Wine Cellar is an organization that you now run.
International Wine Center.
Center, I'm sorry.
That's right.
I said that wrong for the first time. The International Wine Center is an organization that you now run in New York City. What's its mission?
Its mission now is to basically to train people who are in the trade and serious consumers. Its mission is to help people understand wine, not just give them a lot of information about wine. We've been doing this for 20 years, and 25. My, how time flies! Mm-hmm. It's about 25 years now that this has existed, and thousands of people have come through the doors and have learned about wine. And I see it almost as a nurturing process. I see a lot of my students as future masters of wine or future master sommeliers, or even if they don't choose to go that far, as people who can go out into the world of wine either as wine drinkers or as wine professionals with a professional credential. And that gives them the confidence, and one of the things that's necessary is to get rid of the intimidation that exists about wine. So with the confidence, then that evaporates.
Hey, Mary, I want to thank you for coming on the show. We're out of time, but you were great.
Thanks so much, Mary.
It's been great.
Super to have you. That's Mary Ewing Mulligan, Master of Wine at the International Wine Center in New York City and Executive Director for London's respected Wine and Spirits Education Trust. You can find out all about her and those organizations and her books on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, where you'll find a link. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:55. Alex, we got to redo the long introductions for Mary Ewing Mulligan because I didn't mention her most recent book, and here it goes. Mary Ewing Mulligan is a master of wine, president of the International Wine Center in New York City, and executive director of the United States programs for London's respected Wine and Spirits Education Trust. Among several books that bear her name is the best-selling Wine for Dummies and her most... Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest was Mary Ewing Mulligan. I've known Mary for a long time. She is at the top of her field, man. She's a consummate professional, very sophisticated lady. And her husband is Ed McCarthy, and together they wrote Wine for Dummies, which is really a very good book if you're a novice.
And, you know, they've just come out just this past year with a book called Wine Style.
Well, that's not both of them. That's just her.
But it's an interesting concept for wine where style is more important necessarily. You know, the character of the wine is more important than necessarily the quality of wine.
Yeah, it's an interesting book, and it follows a trend of, like, recategorizing wines, mm-hmm. I think, to get people away from the idea that, I'm definitely going to have a Cabernet Sauvignon. Because Cabernet Sauvignon could be light and simple and austere, or a big oaky monster.
Right, but she breaks them down. Like, for instance, the white categories are fresh unoaked, earthy, aromatic white, rich oaky. And so more that it's more important what the purpose that you're going to be drinking wine for is more important necessarily than the quality of wine. I just think it's kind of an interesting concept.
Hey look, I think that's an interesting way to look at things. You know, you had Andrea Immer's book, which was Great Wine Made Simple. She was mm-hmm. she's a master sommelier who we've also known. And you know, I think the idea is to just look at wine in a way that does not make it competitive, does not make it a contest, but helps you. You're not looking for the 99-point wine for as little as you can get it. You're looking for the wine that you're most likely to enjoy. And mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people are attacking that very issue from a number of different ways. But I'm going to make the recommendation out there that the most valuable aid that you can find to finding a good glass of wine or bottle of wine is to find a wine merchant that you trust, and probably not in a big department store, but somebody who's got their own store. store. Like Chris Cree, who's also a master of wine, owns 56 Degrees in Burnettsville. I recommend his store very highly. You know, our restaurant or other restaurants where there are people very concerned with the wine list.
It's actually pretty funny because Francis and I tend to like similar types of wine, but different wines in the same category sometimes. And there are people now who've been coming into the restaurant for years and years and years who will ask, and I'm thinking of one customer named Don, who comes in and he's like, you know, I want, you know, if he's in a category and he's judging between two wines, he'll say, you know, I want the one that Mark would prefer.
Right. Is this a Mark wine or a Francis wine?
And people will ask about
that. And I'll say to people, so do you want a me wine or you want a Mark wine? And I'll recommend the Mark wine if they want. Mary's book, by the way, there's a website I just found. I'm looking on the computer here. It's winestylebook.com. You can go check that out. We're going to put you to all kinds of links with Mary Ewing Mulligan. If you're a sophisticated consumer or a wine professional, you want to take a class with her, recommend it highly. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.